Chapter 46, The History of Christian Philosophy. Section A, There is a Christian Philosophy. We have called Christian philosophy, see Chapter 3, Section C, the philosophy which developed in the environment of the Christian faith and Christian theology. It is a philosophy, since it is reasoning, regarding the highest causes and first principles of reality, understandable to anyone, whether Christian or not. In fact, it is a very powerful philosophy for anyone who really gets to know it. Indeed, it shows that when reason is guided by Christian faith, it can walk more safely. Some modern historians of philosophy have maintained that there was no such thing as a Christian philosophy, but only a Christian theology. When writing the history of philosophy, therefore, they start with the Greeks, bypass the Christian centuries, and go on to the Renaissance, when pure philosophy begins again. But this unwarranted approach has already been surpassed by more recent historians, both Christian and non-Christian, who have taken the trouble of seriously studying the philosophy of the Christian centuries and thereby rediscovering its astonishing wealth and creative thought. The philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas is particularly vigorous and profound precisely as a philosophy. It is not a mixture of faith and reason. St. Thomas always distinguishes faith and reason without confusing them, but also shows their perfect harmony, i.e., how they can never be in conflict. What we can see with reason alone is seen by faith with much more light, and what faith reveals is never against reason, though it often surpasses it. See Chapter 2 and Chapter 21, Sections A and B. Christianity is not a philosophy, but a religion, a supernatural religion revealed by God Himself, and thus claiming to be the true religion, for which it can show its credentials, motives, or credibility. The body of doctrine revealed by God, divine revelation, includes 1. Supernatural truths, i.e. truths which man could never discover by himself, and 2. Natural truths about God and man. Example, that God exists, that he is only one, that he is the creator of the universe, that man has a spiritual and immortal soul, that there is a mortal law, ... These natural truths are also the object of philosophy. Aristotle, for instance, studied them, but by revealing them himself, God wants to guide us, to clarify our minds, like a teacher explaining some difficult matter to a student and thus enlightening him. See Chapter 5, Sections A and B. Many of the truths which the pagans had known were clarified by Christian revelation, so that they did not have to break away from their philosophy altogether, but rather bring it to perfection. This is what happened, for instance, with Saint Justin, who died as a Christian martyr in the middle of the 2nd century. His tradition was then followed by countless others, among whom the great Christian teachers Saint Augustine and Saint Thomas. The latter says that those natural truths about God and man can indeed be known by reason alone, but not easily. Through divine revelation, on the other hand, they are known easily and without error. Section B, The Formation of Christian Philosophy. In Chapter 4, we have already outlined the process of formation of that Christian philosophy reaching its peak in the 13th century. As we said, some historians of philosophy have ignored all this period, dismissing it as just theology. By actually studying it, however, one can verify its superiority in real wisdom to any other period of history. The philosophy which grew up under that theology remains unsurpassed in depth and range. This is understandable when we consider the motivation of those theologians in their philosophizing: to know and understand God better, so as to love Him more, and thus live better as men. The loftiness of this motivation is what made their thought so profound and sublime. On the other hand, as we also said in Chapter 4, Section C, subsequent philosophies have been motivated by human ambitions. Thus, for Descartes, the aim of philosophy must be to empower man to know the world so as to master it. "Knowledge is power," said Francis Bacon. Man wants only his own happiness, then, and God becomes an accessory to it. See Chapter 44, Section B. Philosophy ceases to be a handmaid to theology, becomes a handmaid to human ambition for power and pleasure. This is the decadence of philosophy after the Christian centuries. It becomes fragmented, one for each man, so to speak. Philosophical systems become man-centered, immanentistic, i.e. beginning and remaining in man without transcending him. The Christian theologians, motivated as they were by the love of God, elaborated a highly enlightening philosophy with far-reaching insights, clarifying all human problems, dispelling both the natural darkness of the limited human intelligence and the infranatural darkness brought about by the state of fallen nature. See Chapter 2, Section C. Section C, the content of Christian philosophy. As we said, Christian philosophy accepted many elements from Greek philosophy. But this doesn't mean that Christian philosophy adapted itself to Greek philosophy. What it did was to use the concepts already in circulation and perfect them, as we explained. We mentioned also that the main source was Neoplatonism, as for example, the doctrine of Philo of Alexandria, the Jewish philosopher who attempted a theology of the Bible with the use of Greek concepts. Christians used a great deal of Neoplatonism without absorbing its errors. The highest achievement in this respect is found in St. Augustine, who was born in the 4th century and died in the 5th. After St. Augustine, there was a growing influence from Aristotle, which reached its peak with St. Thomas, who used Aristotle more thoroughly than any other Christian theologian, but adding to it the best of Plato and Neoplatonism, as well as of Jewish and Arab philosophers. The achievement of St. Thomas is precisely to have synthesized the best of all that went before him. Thus, it will be enough for us to take a look at the doctrines of St. Augustine and of St. Thomas in order to get a fair idea of the contents of Christian philosophy. Section D, St. Augustine, 354 to 430. The celebrated Bishop of Hippo explains the relations of faith and reason in great depth. It is not easy to know how both to distinguish them and to unite them, without either separating them or confusing them. St. Augustine did this very well. For him, reason is used by faith in order to develop what one believes. Therefore, reason should not be despised. In fact, faith needs it in order to develop itself. In his philosophical formation, before his conversion to the Christian faith, he came under the influence mainly of Neoplatonism, specifically of Plotinus, whose deeply God-centered philosophy helped him to find his way to the faith. Augustine's quest was for happiness, and he finally found the answer in God. For him, philosophy is the road to God. The true philosopher is one who loves God. Verus philosophus est amator Dei. What is the meaning and purpose of the world around us? To lead us to God. Only the Christian can be completely happy because he possesses the supreme good, and that is philosophy. The means to reach that happiness is to possess the truth, which is found in its entirety only in Christianity. Reason by itself can discover all the natural truths about God and man, but with our faith, we have the best way to know them. That is why he says that if someone does not know God, it is his own fault. The reason for ignorance about God is to be found in the evil passions of man, and the will that goes astray. He uses arguments from reason to prove that God exists, and that he is the unchanging essence. What the sun is for the universe, God is for us, our light and our teacher. The things of the world, changeable as they are, show that they have been created by God, out of nothing. Because, for St. Augustine, the fact that they are changeable indicates an element of nothingness, since for him, to be is to be always the same. This is a very Platonic idea, which St. Thomas would correct, or rather improve, by calling God not an unchanging essence, but the subsistent to be itself, ipsum esse subsistens. St. Augustine also maintains that the ideas of all that exist are in God, that God has somehow sown these ideas in the world of matter as the seeds of all things. This is a Stoic doctrine accepted by St. Augustine, which shows that he did not know Aristotle, i.e., the hylomorphic doctrine. It is characteristic of St. Augustine that his teaching is profound but incomplete, and this gives an idea of Christian philosophy in its process of formation. As for man, he is also influenced by Platonic ideas. He cannot explain very well how the soul is united to the body, as he did not know the Aristotelian doctrine of the soul as the substantial form of the body, see previous chapter. For him, following Plato, man is rather a soul using a body, although he did admit that the body is part of man. Likewise, he could not explain very well the nature of sense perception. Plato had said, as we saw, that sensible things do not really exist, but are only an imitation of the ideas. Reality doesn't change, but sensible things change. Therefore, they are not real. And St. Augustine's tendency is to think in this way too. According to him, our sense knowledge is not to be put on the same level as our knowledge of ideas. There is a sharp division between the sensible and the intelligible worlds. St. Thomas would also correct this Platonic tendency. Without confusion, there is union and continuity of senses and intelligence, as of body and soul. See chapter 26, section B, and chapter 27, section F. All the above explains why some Christian philosophers who have followed St. Augustine more than St. Thomas have fallen into error and even heresy. Not because there are errors or heresies in St. Augustine, but because his doctrines contains more unsettled or obscure points which, without the clarification of St. Thomas, could lead to misunderstandings. This is why the Church insists that we should study St. Thomas above all. The other Christian teachers are also very good, but the angelic doctor is the universal teacher, Doctor Communis. If we follow him, the Church guarantees that we will not go astray. Armed with St. Thomas, so to speak, we can also study the other Christian teachers without the danger of misunderstanding them. See the encyclical Aeterni Patris, mentioned in the foreword and in chapter 4, section C. Regarding the topic of evil, St. Augustine is particularly profound. Before his conversion, he had been under the influence of the Manichees, who believe that evil exists by itself as a substance, when in fact it can only exist as an accident, i.e., in something, as an absence of a good that is due, as a deficiency of being that should be there. See chapter 19, section G, and chapter 35, section D. He came to this conclusion aided by St. Ambrose's remark that evil is the privation of good. The only real evil for St. Augustine is sin, which is caused by the free will of rational beings. See chapter 39, section C. The human will is good in itself, but it can turn to evil by turning away from the last end and thus fall into disorder. See chapter 35, section E. Man, therefore, needs divine grace to put his will right and to fulfill the law of God. St. Augustine is perhaps above all renowned for his book, the city of God, where he says that love made two cities, since there are only two loves, the love of God reaching to the contempt of self, and the love of self reaching to the contempt of God. These two cities, the city of God and the earthly city, subsist together until the end of time. Saint Augustine became the greatest doctrinal authority in the church up to the time of Saint Thomas. This is acknowledged by the latter, who lived 8 centuries later, when he had to correct some points in Saint Augustine's doctrine. He did it with extreme reverence and tact. Section E, Saint Thomas Aquinas, 1225 to 1274. It is the Church herself that has declared, see chapter 4, section B and C, in a continuous chain of rulings and utterances, from the time of his canonization in 1323 up to the present, that if we take the trouble of studying St. Thomas, we will never go astray in our faith or in our philosophy. In all the previous sections of this course on Christian philosophy, we have discussed all the major points of his philosophy, such as 1. The concept of being, ens, as holder of the actuality of being, esse. 2. The creative causality of God, ipsum esse. 3. The world of creatures as participated beings, freely created by God out of nothing. 4. Man as the top creature of the material universe because of his intelligence and free will. 5. The metaphysical foundation of morals as the ordination of the human will to man's last end. 6. The common good as end of man and society. Let us now summarize the spirit of his most important original contributions. As we said in chapter 16, section B, chapter 23, section A, and chapter 45, section C, also chapter 4, section B, his basic insight is, I am who am. God's self-denomination to Moses from behind the burning bush that was not consumed, Exodus 3. This is the starting point in his mind, essential for us if we want to follow his mind as the Church says, Admentum Sant Thome. He had only one basic question in his mind from the time he was 3 years old and asked his governess precisely that, Quid est Deus? What is God? God was from then on what pervaded his mind and his entire existence. It was also around that time that his governess gave him a piece of paper with the Hail Mary written on it, and he was so delighted that he ate it. When later on he found in the Bible the answer to his question, he got the illumination which would guide him in all his thinking ever since. God is to be, and the rest is only a participation in being. While the act of being in God is subsistent, our act of being is participated, limited by our manner of being. And as we said, he took participation from Plato and actuality from Aristotle, raising both to a much higher metaphysical plane under the illumination of his view of God through the Bible's divine revelation. So, here is the theologian illumined by his faith, raising the very best that reason can discover by itself to the higher plane of faith, and thus also helping faith to understand better. Saint Thomas conceived theology as a science whose first principles are received from faith. The articles of the faith, see chapter 2, section A, then from those principles, by means of metaphysics, it draws conclusions. In other words, theology begins with faith, principles equals beginnings, and then it draws conclusions with the help of reason illumined and enlivened by faith. These conclusions are indeed theological, but we cannot thereby say that they are not philosophical as well. Saint Thomas is at his best when distinguishing in order to unite. when analyzing in order to synthesize. This is what he does with faith and reason, theology and philosophy, grace and nature, spirit and matter, intelligence and senses, supernatural virtues and human virtues, the eternal and the temporal, the church and the state, etc., etc. The source of human errors, at least the involuntary ones, is our tendency to either confuse or separate, a tendency carefully avoided by the luminous intelligence of the angelic doctor. His thought is remarkably free from the imbalances, fragmentations, and dislocations so frequent in other thinkers. It is all wondrously unified and harmonized, bright and vigorous. His mind was both sharply analytical and creatively synthetic. Avoiding both the analysis that misses the woods for the trees through short-sighted meticulousness and the hasty generalization that fails to see the complexities of reality through haughty intellectual presumption. While, when analyzing, he dispels confusions, when he synthesizes, he overcomes divisions. It is important, however, to realize the true source of this powerful intelligence. It was not so much that he was born like that, or that he was a genius, but rather that he allowed the fullness of divine illumination through faith to penetrate him thoroughly. Seeing God, then, as the fullness of being, being was therefore what loomed largest in his vision of reality, rather than form, as in the case with most other philosophers. And that which expanded and deepened his intelligence, which was further clarified by the purity and holiness of his personal life. Man's pride inclines him to accept only forms in his thought, rather than being, because forms can be conceptualized, i.e. seized by the human mind, while beings cannot be properly conceptualized in its actuality, as it is the act of all forms and the light of their intelligibility. Intellectual humility is therefore required to accept reality as it is, without trying to adjust it to our mind, but being always ready to learn from it, adjusting our minds to it. Section F, Decadence After St. Thomas. The greatness of his achievement explains to some extent what happened after him. See Chapter 4, Section C. The tendency to formalism asserted itself very strongly, a tendency to think of reality in terms of forms and ignore the importance of the act of being. Even those who called themselves Thomists fell into this trap. Ideas rather than reality have a fascination for man. St. Thomas was the most realistic of all thinkers. Idealism could not be farther from his mind. And this is why the Church recommends him so much, because the best preparation or disposition to receive and nurture the faith is a thorough realism, i.e. a candid and straightforward adherence to things as perceived through the senses and understood through the intelligence. The formalism that prevailed after St. Thomas brought about a decadence of creative thought and paved the way for the Renaissance and for modern philosophy. First, it led to a nominalism, Occam, which considered concepts in the mind as mere names, without any real content. The consequence was skepticism, as to the power of the intellect to really know reality. And this led to voluntarism, the primacy of the will over the intellect, and therefore of subjectivity over objectivity. Protestantism was the religious crisis of this intellectual decadence.